This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
We've got some time for questions now, and I think what people do is they come down to the microphone and they say who they are and where they're from. Oh, we've got a row. Oh, right. Well, no expense spared. We've got a microphone that will come to you over there. Please wait for the microphone to come to you before you start speaking so that we can get you loud and clear. Say who you are. Say who your question is addressed to. You can ask any question you like, including where did my daughter get that Superwoman outfit. That's cool too. And we'll try and get you a response.
Hello. Okay. My question is addressed to both Gail and Karen. At the annual professional forum this morning, we had a big debate about how health visitors can influence national policy. And one of the points that was raised that our professional officer team is really, really important in doing that. And it was noted since the diminution of the professional team, the reduction in the number of officers, this is having a huge impact on our ability to influence national policy. And our plea is really that we need to have more professional officers, particularly for the devolved countries, because we've got one professional officer covering Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, and really they're unable to, with the best will in the world, to be able to do that to the best of their ability.
And just to say who you
Sorry.
Are.
Sorry.
No, that's a great question, but who are you?
Sorry, I'm Maggie Fisher. I'm chair of the Health Visitors Forum.
Okay. I'll take another one, then we can come back. We'll take them in groups of two, so then people can...
Hello, I'm Tricia Kerr Davis from Buckinghamshire. And this is a comment, really, on the last speaker, David McDowell. While I think your arguments are absolutely brilliant, and I think it wouldn't be difficult to use that to demonstrate how our work could produce a saving long term, I think the biggest problem we're facing at the moment is that the people who have the purse strings are actually looking about spending money and saving money within a year gap, and then worrying perhaps not at all about what's going to happen afterwards. And it's convincing them they've got to look much longer term.
Okay, those are two excellent questions. Can we deal with the question? We'll deal with those two and then come out again. The first question that was asked by Maggie, which is, I have to say, something I've noticed, how hard does professional officers work is incredibly difficult. And that was addressed at Gail and Karen. Do you want to have a go at that, Gail?
I do. You know, the thing is, Maggie, that as jobs are lost in the economy, we lose members. The income of our organisation declines. You know that. Fewer health visitors, fewer school nurses, fewer nursery nurses. That's membership income lost to our organisation. Now, Karen Rea, together with Dave Fleming, but Karen in particular, manages the health sector team. And it has to be said to this audience that the health sector team, due to good stewardship, has remained relatively intact compared with other departments in our organisation. Now, in the same way that we've just heard an economist talk about the cost benefits of your intervention, we also talk to the organisation about the cost benefits of a thriving health sector. That's the professional officers and others. So we are fighting furiously to maintain the numbers that we have. We hope that we might add a professional officer to the team very shortly to tackle the issue that you raised about, I think, needing to drill down more into the countries with devolved government. Now, I hope that hasn't slid around too much, and obviously I'm very, very happy, as I'm always very happy, to talk to the National Professional Committee. Just briefly on Tricia's question, you know, in my contribution, I reported to you what a school nurse had said. Do you remember? She said that from 2004 to date, that school nursing service, which was an award-winning service across a group of schools, avoided any teenage pregnancies. That is phenomenal. Imagine the savings. Yet that school nursing service has now been told it may not do sex education in schools. So, you know, this is short-termism. And I fear that the very good case you put on the economy of early intervention in early years is lost because of short-termism. That is a real concern, and well done for raising it, Trish.
I'm going to go straight to David on the economic question.
Yeah, I don't disagree with anything that's just been said, but I would also say that you have to be strategic in your responses and look, try and identify short-termist benefits as well as longer-term benefits. Now, the example I showed about postnatal depression, you can argue an economic case in terms of participation of women in employment if they choose to return to work within a two-year time frame, so a relatively short time frame. You can argue that people are going back to work, paying taxes, etc., and not therefore and contributing to the economy that way. So it is a question of looking for short-term benefits as well and not being apologistic about that. You know, it may be an uncomfortable thing to do to try and find these arguments. So for the interventions in the early years for kids, what are the immediate impacts they have on parents and the disruption to parents' lives, the time the parents have to take off work to deal with the problems that the kids have? Look at those kinds of issues. And also never forget the longer-term issues as well. And I would also say, I mean, it's for unions and others, but if this is an issue, early interventions, where there is political general consensus, then is there a way, I don't know, I'm being naive now, I'm not a politician, but is there a way political parties can think long-term about some aspects of things, you know, and take the politics out of
I think there's an interesting argument there. One of the things that you've probably heard this afternoon repeated by both the Chancellor and the Prime Minister was the idea that the CSR review was about the long-term. So it's possible to use their argument, you know, if you're thinking about the long-term, here's how you calculate it. And in fact, if the retention of increased access to psychological therapies, the retention of that funding, I know, happened as a direct result of an economic argument made that said, if you take away access to mental health, it will cost more. I actually don't think we use those arguments enough. Okay, so let's take a couple more, please. Who have we got? Right, take you, then we're going to go over there.
Hello, my name is Niamh Hamlin. I'm a CPHVA rep.
Hold the microphone
from,
a bit closer.
CPHVA rep from No Frills, North Yorkshire, New York PCT. And I'm interested in what David McDabe was saying, because although I can see the arguments that could be made to management for certain task-orientated things, like, for instance, screening for postnatal depression, I think it's much more difficult to make the arguments in other areas, particularly in one of the things that's actually being cut at the moment, which is contact with clients, because building relationships with clients, I see, is absolutely the foundation of health visiting. And the other thing, on a personal note, is how could we make a good economic argument to management for more time off for health visiting reps, more time in the workplace to actually become, to get people to become active, because actually that would have a great economic outcome for us and for all workers.
Great question. Let's take another one over there, please.
Thank you. In the annual professional forum, Carolyn Taylor, Chair of the Nursing Occupational Advisory Committee. In our group this morning, we looked at leadership and in professional practice. But one of the things that very strongly came across was that many of us within this room feel very disempowered to do what you're requesting us to do in terms of actually giving this information to managers. So I think I would request, you know, on behalf of my colleagues, is that if we can produce some short bullet point scenarios, some information around the economic arguments that practitioners can then have to hand, which then they can take to management and will help them to empower them to get back up there and fighting for what we know truly we should be fighting for.
That's a good point. Okay, we got our question there from No Frills, which are cracking title. And then Caroline, who's going to go with those? I think perhaps, Gail, do you want to start? Oh, Karen, yeah, do you want to start with the...
Actually, can I go to Caroline's point? I would like
please
to pick up that one. I mean, I think it's twofold, Carolyn, and I think it's about getting activists active, which is not just those people that are local reps. It is all of our colleagues. It is about influencing. We're only going to change things if we change things together. And, you know, community practitioners, and I was a rep for a very long time, and how many times do you turn around and there's nobody there behind you? Or your colleagues complain because you're taking time out to do trade union or professional activity. So we've got to address that collectively. And I do agree, we've got to give you the tools and the information and the points. When I'm going to talk to David after this to see if we can get anything very specifically targeted towards community practitioners to those examples. However, there is a point, is it, that our managers out there, your managers out there, we've got to make them listen. They're not keen to listen, but we do have to put those arguments to them and also to the general public. Our campaign is not just about convincing managers. It's the pressure the general public can put on the boards of the primary care trusts or whatever will happen in the future, i.e. GP commissioning. So it is about togetherness. It sounds really crash thing to say, but unless we are all together, all of us, not one voice is going to be heard.
I have to say, your managers are going to be changing. You do know that, don't you? I think
or losing should, their jobs.
You need to be thinking about GPs. You know, you need to make in the case to a different kind of resource holder, I think. Sorry, please.
Yes, I was about to say good luck. to the no-frills colleague, because we didn't catch your name, sorry. I've been working very hard since the election of the government with the minister responsible for government, really, Francis Maude. And we've had some success in slowing down certain things that I think would be really damaging on what we call fair deal, preventing a two-tier workforce. So it's engagement is important. Completely see that, and that's what you need us to do. But on this question of time off for trade union reps, at the same time that the ACAS code for time off for trade union reps has been improved and upgraded, mostly because of the evidence that shows trade union engagement in every workplace provides what's called a union advantage. Better pay, safer workplaces, better learning environment, with the consequential benefits to the employer. Despite that, in opposition, the Conservative government put forward a battery of questions about time off and the cost of time off and facilities, offices, etc. In local authority, the Daily Telegraph put through freedom of information requests on the costs to local authority of trade union facilities and time off. And the Taxpayers Alliance, most recently, has put forward freedom of information requests to enumerate the cost in pounds, shillings and pence, old money, of trade union time off and facilities. Now, you know, you can see the way this is going. So what, you know, you can see the bigger picture.
Don't have a legal right, though?
Yes, absolutely. Trade union representatives have the right to time off for trade union duties. But the Telegraph, Taxpayers Alliance, and prior to being government, the Conservatives were building up, whipping up, if you will, a concept that trade union activity in the workplace was costly. And in the public sector, who pays the bill? You, the taxpayer. Quite ignoring all the evidence about the union advantage. So I couldn't agree with you more. And I'm pleased to say I've got a slot with Chris Grayling. And I'm going to be in the green room with him for a couple of hours before speaking on a joint panel at the Chartered Institute for Professional Development annual conference. And I will go blue in the face in that opportunity with Chris Grayling, the minister responsible for BIS, the department in Westminster, blue in the face, pressing home the importance of the union advantage. We've got to do it. You need the time to do the job, especially in this environment.
I think that's true. I've got to be honest, we've got 2,500 people that work at Turning Point, and frankly, I couldn't give a monkey's chuff what the Telegraph says or the Taxpayers Alliance. I remind our managers that there is a legal duty and a direct organisational benefit, and I think it would help. In my experience, a lot of managers in the NHS simply don't know what the duty is, and it'd be useful to remind them, as well as to go, as going blue in the face. Let's take a couple of questions. Let's take some at the front. There's that lady there, and the woman in green just in the centre there.
I'm Norma Dudley. I'm a health visitor in London, and I'm on the NPC of the CPHVA, National Professional Committee. It was a comment really about what Karen was saying about the NHS campaign, and I think we're hearing lots of doom and gloom, and where I'm working I feel quite gloomy about my prospects as a health visitor. But the one thing that, and hearing what Carol was saying was quite scary about what the possibilities for us are if we, you know, the NHS goes down the fragmentation and privatisation route. But the one thing that we do have on our side is the public, really, and public opinion. And it was to ask how we demystify everything around GP commissioning and what it really means. Because once the public understand, I mean, I think it is deliberately obfuscated, deliberately, you know, not clear. Where I live locally and where I work, our PCT have secretly, secretly and underhandedly decided to sell off one of our local health clinics. It's a very old building. It's one of those interwar years buildings. But our local Keep Our NHS Public group has got a bit of a campaign together. And we were petitioning in this very poor area of Leighton last Saturday. And, you know, we were overwhelmed with support. And we had, you know, old ladies saying, I'm going to take the petitions away to my church. So I think, sorry, I'm going on.
I'm just keen to get as many questions in before we close.
Yes.
I think I'm getting your point there, which is, how do we take the argument to the public? How do we get the public's concerns out there? I think that's absolutely a very good question.
Hello, yes, my name's Karen Hoare. I'm an ex-health visitor, although I like to think I'm still a health visitor. I'm a nurse practitioner who works now in University of Auckland and South Auckland in New Zealand. And I've been out of the country for 7 years. Before I left, I was a health team leader on a Sure Start programme back in 2001/2002. We knew all the evidence then that David was talking about, the importance of early intervention, postnatal depression, and we were implementing it. And I do remember seeing a Lancet article not that long ago about the benefits of Sure Start, and just wondered, am I in a time warp? What's happened over the last 10 years?
Yes, you are in a time warp. It's 1982. Okay, so Norma's question and Karen's question. Do you want to have a go?
Yes,
let's bring you in.
I'd like to respond to Norma's question. So I find it quite interesting about how you demystify GPI commissioning with the general public. I'm married to a GP, and he asked me to ask the question of the people here, what is GP commissioning? So I can tell you, the general public don't stand a chance. But, you know, trying to broach that quite seriously, GPs have had some minimal attempt at commissioning previously, as you're probably aware. It's not quite the same thing. This consortia development will need a great deal of support and advice to get it right. I don't think there's any doubt that they're going to have to do it. So I think it behoves health visitors and community practitioners to get in there at the beginning and advise them how to do it. Don't let them think they know how to do it all on their own. I shall certainly be banging on the door of the BMA and the General Medical Council and the Royal College of General Practitioners, and I think you should all bang there as well.
I have to say, I mean, the BMA is and the Royal College are not exactly rushing at this stuff with open arms, and I do think there's a genuine opportunity to join forces.
Absolutely.
And ask some serious questions about the viability of this idea. Carol, you wanted to...
And just on your comment there about, you know, how do you educate the public? I think part of the problem, and I'll speak on our experience in Canada, where we have universal health care and where it has been under attack now for many years, and they've tried to erode it. But, you know, they do it in such a way that they present to the public, you know, they package it a certain way that it looks attractive. You know, certainly what they have done over the years is as they continue to take money out of our healthcare system, and I believe it's done on purpose, to create things like, you know, longer waiting lines for elective surgery or longer waiting lines to see surgeons. Now, all of a sudden, they have this great solution over here. Oh, you know what? If we had a private clinic, we could have people get away from those waiting lines and go over here. So they package it in a nice way. They don't talk about all the downsides. Some of the things that we have done in the labor movement in Canada is we've identified the allies that we have in the communities, and we try to wage our campaign with these allies and bring these things to the forefront and make sure that when we hear all these great messages about how wonderful the privatization is going to be, get people to start thinking about all the downsides to it. And be under no illusion. These things are very well thought out, and we're not just dealing with these issues now country by country. We're dealing with these issues on a global scale. And what's happening in the United States, I mean, it's just beyond me how the people in the United States they've been fighting. They've been fighting for universal health care now for over 100 years in the United States. I mean, that's very difficult to comprehend why the people have not been out in the streets fighting and saying, you know, enough is enough. So I think, you know, we start with our membership, we start in our communities, we start identifying our allies, and we start really unraveling these nice pictures that are being painted out there about these new systems.
David, the question that was asked by Karen was the kind of, you know, back to the future, you know, have we been here before? Have these arguments about cost benefit, have they been used before? Is it something we can learn from how they've been used if we're going to use them again or use them more forcefully?
I would actually argue that we haven't made the economic arguments as strongly before as we are doing now. I mean, certainly the arguments on the effectiveness of interventions and the long-term impacts on kids have been well known, but I think it's only relatively recently there's been a lot more focus on the economic case for preventing things happening. And a good example of this actually is the fact that NICE, this national committee that decides on things, it set up a public health committee in 2005, so much more recently than the committee in 1999 on drugs, and they've been doing a lot of great work. I'm biased because I'm on the committee, but they have seriously been doing a lot of great work demonstrating the economic case for prevention. And I think that is new. Economists have not done as much work on it, quite frankly, because there's no money in prevention. There's lots of money from drug companies to do drug studies, but to get the money to do assessments of the benefits of remaining healthy or preventing things has not happened. But those arguments do need to be made. And it's the same as going back to the business of GP commissioning again. The fact that we're revisiting something, albeit in a different form, that we had 20 years ago. And there's many other things within the health system. Constant change, constant recycling. You can think of when the Labour government came in, it got rid of some things, then it reintroduced them 4 or 5 years later as well. So there's a lot of unnecessary rejigging around with ideas as well. But anyway.
Okay, I'm going to take three more questions, three quick questions if we've got them, but please make them briefs, no Gettysburg addresses, and then we're going to have brief answers from the front. Right at the back there, I've got you.
I'm Bernie McRae from Northern Ireland. And I have retired from health visiting, but I'm still active as a trade union in trade union rep training. I just want to make a couple of comments, really, rather than questions, to Gail and to David. Insofar as the NHS is concerned, I do think that we should be throwing our weight in behind the trade unions in all the four countries. They have been having demonstrations and rallies. And I do think that Joe Public doesn't have a voice, and the trade union movement can give Joe Public a voice. And I think we should be recruiting as many people as we can. One of my colleagues over here talked about distributing leaflets, and I think this is what we ought to be doing.
Very good.
So far as the David's presentation, which was excellent, with regard to mental health. We had a conference in mental health, the ICTU did, last year. And because I belong to the disability angle, it was mental health we focused on. And as a result of that, ICTU provided training for trade union activists in the suicide prevention, which is very high in Northern Ireland, and also in first aid in the workplace. At the award ceremony last week, the director of mental health in the Health Protection Agency, he made the point that this is not going to be tackled alone. That he was delighted that it was extended down to the trade union workplace, because often it is colleagues who can help colleagues.
Excellent.
And are the first.
Got your point.
Okay.
Two more brief questions. Lady in the pink. And you haven't asked before, have you? So we'll go for you. Might be a reward for getting quick questions.
Oh, right. Angela Lewis, Chair, Yorkshire and the Humber. Karen, where do you want us to be at 8:45, ready to put on our T-shirts?
Sorry about this. I'm just reading a draft press release to go out on the spend review. 9:15 at the front. You know where the hotel is? In between the bits there? Yeah, just there. And then we'll decide where is the best bit for the photographer to take the picture of all of you and your blue.
In that case, then, we can fit another one. It's right next to you.
I'm Elaine Baptiste. I'm a health visitor at LAR in Moreton Forest. My question is, how do we keep the morale of staff up? Where I'm working, we're firefighting daily. We've got rising caseloads, on average 700 to 800 children per full-time health visitor. We have staff in a shortage. We've lost about 14 health visitors in our trust since January. We're constantly just battling just to try and keep our heads above water. How is CPHVA going to help the health visitors to actually keep their morale up, keep working, keep fighting, keep children safe, and continue to feel good about the job they're doing?
It's a great question. Thank you. We'll take the last one.
I'm Penny Ballinger. I'm a former health visitor who writes poetry.
Whoa.
I just thought it was really interesting, Carol Landry's description of why we should be so frightened about privatisation of the healthcare system in this country. But we must remember that under a new Labour government, managers were being sent on jollies to find out about opportunities for privatised healthcare from trusts while the health visiting service was being allowed to wither. And I think there is a great opportunity with GP commissioning. I, for certain, do not regret the loss of the PCTs, because so much money was wasted. Chief executives with chauffeur-driven cars, lots of jollies. And I think probably that's why we're paying for it a little bit now.
Okay, fine. I think we will go just down the line. Quick responses. To all those questions, our friend from Northern Ireland, basically talking about Northern the unions, Elaine, which are a very, very powerful question. How do we motivate the day-to-day? How do we keep that motivation high? How do we keep it focused? And then Penny's question, which is more about, well, actually, you know, it's going to change. PCTs weren't all that good. So, you know, what's the response? Angela.
Going on to the motivation question, which is probably the one I'm best able to answer, I would suggest that we listen very carefully to Anne Milton's presentation tomorrow, because I think she may have some announcements to make about health visiting and community practice. In the interim, it might be advisable to ask managers to home in to what Anne Milton is having to say as well, because it's them that need to listen in order that they can then slow down this loss that we have of health visitors, and I think it's at the rate of one every 36 hours, which is enormously sad. But we have been promised by this new government 4,200 health visitors. I want them to tell us how that's going to happen, and I want to hear it tomorrow.
Can I just add, I think we should invite Anne Milton to come and visit you, and I'll come with her, actually. We'll come and visit you. I think that's the part. You come and visit. Please, Gail.
Yeah, you know, in relation to jollies and the highest paid in any of the public services, one of the things that could be looked at and is being looked at by a bloke called Will Hutton is wage ratios. Trouble is, government's asked him to look at wage ratios at a far too high level, 20 to 1, rather than the campaigning ratio of at least of 1 to 10. So I'm not against looking at excesses at the very top, but my fear, frankly, is that GP fund holding, when it was introduced previously, wasn't good in outcome. It was voluntary, and an awful lot of GPs didn't volunteer to take up GP fund holding, whereas the BMA are currently pointing out it's mandatory. Whether they like it or not, or if they feel they have the skills, that's going to be foisted on them. And I've got real concerns because I think commissioning is more likely to be taken over by commissioning enterprises that will be private sector driven with a private sector ethos. Now, in relation to Bernie's question, of course, Bernie, you talked up quite rightly the role of the TUCs in Ireland, Scotland, Wales, not just the TUC that I'm a member of, that's UK-wide. But, you know, it isn't just about protests. And funnily enough, I think Norma answered her own question, because Norma said, how do we popularise? And it goes really to Elaine's question too. How do we popularise our message? And in fact, you popularise the message. You had them queuing up to join you. And if that doesn't boost our morale, I don't know what does. But it isn't just about protesting. It's about putting the alternative argument. And we have been building the alternative economic argument against the orthodox economy of cutting back in the way that's being pushed by government. So all of the TUCs have a really vital role to play, but we are the largest, with 7 million members, we're the largest voluntary sector organisation. We've already got a big society.
Go unite. Yes. Okay, Carol.
Well, I really have nothing to... I mean, I think Gail covered it well. And I mean, all we can do is continue to work, continue to share information as it comes along, and try to work together and push back where we can. And I don't know how you go about making changes in government here, but, I mean, we have a large lobbying sector in the steelworkers in Canada and the U.S., and we just stay on these politicians day after day after day and just keep pushing back and getting the word out. I think that's the biggest thing we can do.
Karen?
I think two small points. One is you're talking about costings, and as Gail mentioned about money, the internal market costs us £20 billion. That's where we make the savings. That's very clear. From Norma knows how I feel about what's happening in London. The offices in London are trying to do as much as they can to support the health visitors and campaign and lobby, and we don't stop. I think you are right. We've got to lobby not just the government that are in, but the shadow government as well, and anybody, the public, anybody who can influence change and ensure that, you know, community practitioners clearly have a future and a necessity to play for for future generations.
David.
I'll make a tangential point, but a relevant one. In the mental health area, some things that are now happening in England have happened because of what happened in Scotland first. So the arguments that because we've got a devolved country, making arguments and pointing to good experience in Scotland or other places can have a very powerful persuasive argument with the public as to why things aren't happening in England as well. So that's another important thing to think about, the devolution and what that means for the way you make messages.
Thank you for your questions. Thank you for the panel. I'm going to hand back to Angela.